to another episode of the Double Comma Club with your host, Nicole Ruth of the Ruth Team, the number one lending team in Colorado.
All right, I want to introduce you to Rolex. That is her nickname. Nicole's our number one producing branch manager in all of Fairway, and she is amazing. This year, Nicole's going to hit 280 million. Incredible. She's my friend. It's just been such a blast to watch her just grow over the years. And she's going to be introducing our next, and we are so excited. Ivy, it's like Christmas to have you here. All right, Nicole, handing it over to you.
Well, I do get the pleasure, thank you, Sarah, of introducing Ivy Zelman. Ivy and I have had, I've been honored to become kind of a confidant and a friend of Ivy's lately. I'll say that lightly. I'm going to keep treading on that water and asking her for things that I want. She is an amazing, amazing resource of information, of data. She collaborates with a number of, in fact, I think it's 1,000 private companies collaborating data that you just can't get access to in any other way. She's been doing this for over 30 years. And some of the bits from her bio that really stuck out to me when I know how intelligent, well thought of, and well spoken Ivy is, but how accurate she is in her assessment of the market from her years of diving deep. When I read this in 2005, she called the top of the housing market. Ivy famously called the Toll Brothers CEO Bob Toll on the second quarter 2006 Toll Brothers conference call, which Kool-Aid are you drinking? I mean, she nailed it. And then later from there, Ivy called the bottom of the housing market in January 2012, thus reinforcing her dominant reputation, and became quoted in The Big Short when read, all roads lead to Ivy. Mm-hmm. I know she's also a good friend of Jim Cramer's, who I have deep respect for. So she is, Zelman & Associates was formed in 2007. After years of doing the research that she's been doing, she's now started Zelman & Associates, one of the leading housing research providers on Wall Street. The firm differentiates itself by providing deep dive thematic research overlaid with monthly proprietary surveys across all silos of the housing ecosystem. This enables Zelman to triangulate all the inputs to generate the most accurate forecasts for all housing metrics in the industry. That's a lot of $5 words, but what it really, it boils down to, and what I love so much about reading every research that we get from Ivy, and Fairway Mortgage has recently started to participate as one of her companies that she provides surveys to and gathers the research from. But what I get from that is the fact that she does it like no other. She does something different than everybody else. So when other people are looking for the easy wins in what data is provided, she says, that's simply not enough. I'm going to go down deeper. I'm going to really find out what's making this market move. And I'm going to identify it so that my clients that I serve can help make the best decisions for their profitability, for their clients, for their employees. And with that, I'm going to turn the camera over to Ivy Zelman. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Nicole. I really appreciate that kind introduction. I am going to kick off right now, but just to begin, we now have a new president. I think we all recognize that President-elect Biden will be inaugurated January 20th, but we do have a runoff in Georgia, and which will determine whether or not we'll have gridlock in Congress or whether we'll have a Democratic sweep. Some of the things that could really impact the housing market, assumingly, if President-elect Biden's proposals related to housing come to fruition, one of which is a tax credit for first-time buyers for $15,000, which would be advanceable and permanent. I don't believe this would be a good thing. I think it would juice up a market that's not in need of demand, but clearly is more supply constrained. But certainly that would just create more home price inflation. Secondly, they're contemplating forgiving student loan debt. It's debatable at the magnitude, but right now the numbers are 10,000 for those that have earned less than $125,000 of income. And then also just the policy related to immigration. And just knowing that we could see a more favorable backdrop that could allow for the constraints in the labor force and the construction industry to be mitigated as well. But still questions remain, and we'll go and we'll move on. So demographics, I think as we look and see in the number of 20 to 34 year olds has been decelerating, really starting back in 2011 after it peaked. And by 2025 to 2030, it will actually be negative. And this is actually a challenge and a headwind for our friends in the multifamily industry, more so than single family. And if you look, as the millennials have been aging, we see the growth really starting to come to fruition only really in earnest in 2017. And that will accelerate and continue to be the case, which is a great backdrop for single family, because we believe that the decision to leave a multifamily dwelling versus living with your parents is really about family formation and, well, getting married and then hopefully family formation in that order. And so you think about the number of people that actually live in a single family home, those that are married between the ages of 30 and 39. Our data shows if you are married and have two children, 82% will live in a single family home. And that's really about the need for space. As we, those of us that are married, know it's hard enough being married. Imagine living in a 900 square foot apartment and adding two children. So with that backdrop, we think single family will see significant demand from this demographic positive tailwind. So let's talk about what I think the media has been talking about, which is, you know, this complete deurbanization phenomena that's happened from COVID. What we want to show you is that our data actually shows that this is a phenomena that's already been happening for the past, call it 6 to 8 years. So we created an index. We call it our GDI index. Zero is the most extreme suburban area or rural area you can live in, versus 100, which would be the most densely populated area you can live in. And what you see here is a time frame from 2012 to 18, the change in adult population. You can see that the extremely suburban markets were actually growing, those between the GDI of zero and nine, versus the extremely urban that was already under pressure. So COVID just took this trend and put it on steroids. But that trend was already in place. And that's really the dynamics, as I just pointed out, with the demographics, that we're seeing deceleration in young adults, and the millennials are, again, aging into that point of getting married and starting families. So the big sea change in the market is really remote work. I think remote work has accelerated what we call the Great American Shuffle, but just similarly to what happened with respect to the already fleeing urban markets that had been in place, we have already been seeing a Great American Shuffle. The fact that we have, prior to COVID, 6 to 7% of those between the ages of 20 and 64 that are working remote, and now that could accelerate. Some forecasts are saying it could go as high as 20 to 30%. That could create more of this shuffle that I'm referring to. And it's not necessarily leaving states to go to other states, but leaving those urban markets to maybe travel further out to a third ring because you're not worried about commuting and your employer gives you more optionality. So you can now come to the headquarters maybe once or twice a week. So there's just a lot of opportunity for single family to benefit in those further out markets or even move entirely to a different state. So what I wanted to show you here is that the Great American Shuffle has been underway for quite some time now. 2010 to 2020, we estimate household growth ran about 9%. And those numbers are not finalized until the decennial survey will be out. But there's states that are growing much faster than that. Many of these are red states that are growing, as Utah up 20, Texas up 20. So these states have been very strong areas for builders and continuing to see the robust pace of growth, I think, going forward has only now accelerated further because those people that are living in the cold weather climates that are high tax cost states, they can now move because of remote work to anywhere they want. And we're seeing markets explode. Austin, for example, is on fire as one that comes top of mind. Florida is just booming everywhere. And Carolinas, Arizona, Idaho is another one that's just been a beneficiary of many Californians migrating out. Our home builders, Nicole mentioned, we do a proprietary survey. We actually aggregate several hundred private home builders. They're representing about 15 to 20% of the new home market, which compares to the publicly traded home builders, which we follow. That means we rate them buy, hold, or sell. They're about 40% of the market. So you see that October, we did see over 50% growth. November is now decelerated, but still very robust. In September, we're up over 70%, which is just not sustainable. And we're now anniversarying tougher comparisons. November 19 over 18 was up over 40%. So that's part of the deceleration. It's also because the builders are running out of lots. Their communities are selling so much faster than they had anticipated. So they're now constraining releases and raising prices because they have that much demand, but they don't want to have further gap outs of not having new communities to replace the ones that are actually currently open. I just wanted to show you that this is broad-based pretty much across the country. The trends are very favorable. We are seeing a little bit of deceleration more in the West than the East. And then just looking at housing starts have actually been really running behind the new order strength that we've been seeing. And this has a lot to do with constraints from municipalities, labor, and just getting those communities open from just the sewers, roads, and pipes being put in place take time. But starts are starting to catch up. This is again coming from our proprietary survey. We saw starts out this morning, still not enough. We need more starts to meet the demand of those contracts that have been written. This just shows you depicted on how much below historic levels when we look at the production home building starts relative to orders, that gap is definitely well below historic levels, which would bode well for the future level of starts that you'll be seeing from the Census Bureau released as we continue to see that catch up. And it bodes well for the economy because it creates more jobs as the housing market is instrumental in leading the economy out of this recession. And certainly this growth is going to continue. One of the challenges, though, this is coming from our proprietary land development survey that we do quarterly, is land constraints. So A, B, and C, think of the C as the third ring of a market. You know, up until the builders got the memo that they, if you build it, they will come, which they really didn't start building out in the outer rings because they were afraid that people wouldn't drive to qualify. You could see that the C locations, that third ring, anything below 50 means it's constrained, as opposed to 50 being normal. So you can see that even in the C locations, we have a constraint on available inventory for land in finished lots as compared to A and B are almost non-existent. So let's talk about the markets where we actually have seen slow growth. These numbers are not going to surprise you in terms of the dense markets. My home state of Ohio, formerly a New Yorker, you can see that we're seeing states well below that 9% that we saw for the US. This shouldn't be that surprising because these are just more densely populated markets. Take Ohio, you know, the households in Ohio are twice the median of the United States. So recognizing that what we have is a lot older stock. And for those of you that have been working with your realtor partners, knowing that there was a lot of stock that just was dated and consumers were just not willing to put CapEx in, I think that the mortgage rates falling has enabled a lot of people to unlock value, but we do think that we'll see more refurbishment, another good positive for the market to sustain supporting appreciation with more investment in homes. The stock in the United States is about 45 years old, and where you could see in the Northeast being the oldest, and that really just makes it more challenging for those people in those markets to get the appreciation or get the sale price that they're looking for, again, if they don't make that investment, as opposed to the, you know, younger states and the Texas market and Southwest where there's a lot of younger stock. Inventory, you guys are probably used to hearing about inventories in a month supply. Realtors, as a rule of thumb, like you'll talk about a 6 month supply is a balanced market. Anything below 6 months would likely mean inflation for home prices, above 6 months, deflation. What we like to look at, though, is so we can form a trend line and look back over decades, is the number of single family homes available for sale divided by households. Inventories are at an all-time record low for this trend line. And actually, they had been running at an all-time record low prior to COVID. And we'll talk a little bit about why in a moment. But that number post-COVID has fallen another 25 to 30%. So actually, we originally thought home prices, no matter how bad a recession would be, that demand would still outstrip supply. And we actually were looking for on March 25th, when the world was coming to a complete shutdown, that home prices would be up 3%. Our forecast is now 9.7% for 2020. And I'll talk about our forecast later, but just with respect to home prices, because of this constraint, we actually think 2021 home prices will be up another 6%. And just the tightness is remarkably tight. And part of that is really driven by, I'll talk about the aging of the population. Despite this tightness, we talk about velocity. We're at record levels of velocity. And you guys know this. So when houses get listed, those that get sold in the same period are now in the same month are at an all-time record level. And if you looked at the monthly data, it's even higher than the annual 20 numbers in the 40% range, just showing you how hot a market we're in today. I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with this country and how it relates to really what's been a secular pressure that has really started, call it 2000 to where we are today, which is that less households are moving. And that deceleration you see depicted, call it 15 to 11 over this time frame, is really a result of the graying of America, boomers aging, seniors aging, because as we get older, we tend to move less. So if we look at this chart, and I won't tell you where I am, but in this frame, in this age category somewhere, most people tend to move less. So 9% in my little cohort here in a given year move, as compared to those younger people that are in their 20s are moving, half of them are moving in a given year. So while the Generation Xers, the boomers, and the seniors are aging, that's constraining people willingly listing their homes. But with COVID and with rates falling, that trend is diminishing, which is a positive for the move rate. The other factor that has also been a significant drag on the market, as you guys recall, prior to COVID, really the move-up market, especially luxury, was lackluster at best. And there was some markets even showing deflationary pressures, including New York City, that's been under pressure really since the peak of 14. But discretionary upgrades for those aged 45 to 59 just were really not accelerating. And part of that goes back to the idea is I'm going to, one, move up and buy a home that needs a lot of work and give up my low rate, and I can't sell the house for what I want to sell it for. So there's just been this bottleneck of a lack of willingness to upgrade, which is now also diminishing as we're seeing move up is really exploding. And the next data point has been second homes. Second homes, this just shows you for the GSEs, how much of the GSE mortgage are second homes. You know, the 60% depicted here from July to September is actually, I think, a little bit misleading because there's a lot of second homes that are well above the GSE loan limits. And I'd say that the numbers have been the strongest in some of the resort destinations with our broker survey, which we do on a monthly basis. We actually survey more than 10% of existing home sales. They're talking about hundreds of percent increases in some of their resort markets. So it's just been a, you know, take advantage. I call it free money. Go take as many, buy as many homes as you can with where rates are today, because it's crazy favorable. We show that one of the backlashes of low rates is the fact that so many borrowers are going to have rates below 4%. Dan's data said 52, we're close at 49. But what really worries me, I guess, is if Barry's right, it's not a worry, rates aren't going anywhere. But if we had rates, even if 30-year fixed rates were to go up to 3.5 or 3.75, we could see a lot of people in the move-up market say, you know, I refied, I'm at 2.8, I'm not going anywhere. And that had been part of the reason why inventories had been constrained, because mortgage rates are not transferable. So when 2018, we saw that, wow, the housing market slowed and mortgage rates are at 5%, how the hell can that happen? Mortgage rates are so low. I remember when mortgage rates were 10%, or I remember when mortgage rates were 16% in the 80s. So people don't appreciate that the lower that you can lock in at these favorable rates, either on a purchase or a refi, we're going to see a backlash if rates ever go up. But I'm more in Barry's camp that rates aren't likely going anywhere. And if they do bump up, you'll probably see that it's only temporary, because there is every year there's variability from 50 to 100 basis points in the swing in mortgage rates. So just touching on affordability very quickly, because if you look at 100 and just said that that's the index that's sort of normalized, anything below it is favorable. So while home prices have been appreciating, and as Dan pointed out, incomes have been rising, mortgage rates falling has really allowed for the favorability to continue. This is theoretically for an entry-level buyer. It doesn't incorporate the balance sheet or any incremental costs besides principal, interest, and insurance. But I think what it says is that it is a good time to buy. The problem in the market is not demand. It's just the lack of affordable product in the market. And, you know, people get very frustrated when they're looking, because they can make three or four offers and they could be outbid. And typically they're being bidding against all cash buyers coming from investors, especially at the entry level price point, that are fix and flippers, or the single family rental market, which is in the market with all cash buyers is there too. So this is, affordability is great. It's just that we don't have enough product. So Nicole also mentioned our mortgage survey. So we survey about 20% of the market, and I'm really excited to have the Lion Chasers getting involved. What we do is provide you the research in exchange for your pulse of the market. So every month we ask our mortgage originators, if you're going to underwrite a loan today on stringency, 100 being you can't get a mortgage, 0, you can fog a mirror and get a mortgage, which was the case back in 05, 50 is normal. You could see that in 2020, because of COVID, and we'll talk about a little bit what's going on, the stringency has increased and has remained more elevated. And this is really a function of the policy that the administration put in place initially on forbearance, which we were in chaos for a while. But it's also because there's so much demand that mortgage lenders like yourselves can be pickier in who you want to lend to. But it's also the forbearance risk that's still prevalent, albeit it's nowhere near as bad as the market thought it was going to be. So if we look at forbearance, back in June, the level of or number of people that were in forbearance actually peaked at 8.6%. And just interestingly, we thought there was going to be a lot of moral hazard because you didn't have to prove that you were actually unable to make your mortgage payments. So we thought there would be a lot more borrowers taking advantage of that. But the numbers have just dramatically been improving. So while the numbers have been improving, we have to think about the risk of foreclosures. I would put it at, yeah, there might be a few, but in terms of impacting home prices, we are so starved for inventory, like I showed you in the inventory constraint market. So those struggling borrowers, they're not going to go to foreclosure because they have equity. 35% of homeowners don't have a mortgage. 2% today have negative equity. So those that have to sell their home can pay the mortgage off and probably help a starved market by providing more inventory, even though, as Barry mentioned, it's a terrible thing for those that have to sell. There's also sale leaseback programs now where people can rent their own homes. A lot of startups backed by VCs are figuring out ways to take advantage for these struggling borrowers not to lose their home. So that's a negligible part of the market right now, but something that we see that's evolving. So just really quick before I wrap up, I want to give you some highlights on the multifamily market and single family rental. So multifamily, as I mentioned, has a harder backdrop because of the headwinds demographically. But also, if we look at a lot of data here on this chart, but I want you to look at the year end under construction, the furthest on the right. We are right now going back historically. We only show it to 11, but we are at a multi-decade high of inventory for multifamily in backlog. And this is predominantly urban class A high rise. So there was a wall of capital chasing this asset class because they believed the Sam Zells and Jeff Gundlachs of the world that homeownership was in a secular decline. And the wall of capital kept providing funding for development. And now it's going to be even more challenging because young people are leaving the cities. But COVID now with office, with 10% occupancy in New York City and just on death row, I think that this is going to further pressure lease rates. And we've seen lease rates declining at a double-digit rate in cities like New York and San Francisco and LA and Boston. This just shows you our revenue forecast. We do expect that the blended revenue growth, which includes occupancy and lease rate, seeing some slight improvement in November from what had been these trough levels in September. But this is also benefiting from those suburban assets and Class B that is doing well better again than the Class A in the urban core. So really quickly on single family rental, this is a hot market. It's one that's evolved from what we called the new old thing because single family rental has been around for decades. There's actually an association called the National Association of Single Family Property Managers with 3,500 members. But it wasn't until 2011, 2012 that people even started realizing that it was a segment of the market with 15 million people renting homes because institutional investors started to enter the market. They're pretty negligible in total with only about 2% of the market. But again, 15 million people rent homes. And today, when we look at what's happening, we're actually seeing very strong rent growth because single family, even though I mentioned 82% of people live in a home if they're married with two children in a single family asset between the ages of 30, 39, this is actually the same benefit demographically for single family rental as it is for the owned market. So we're seeing strong pricing power and occupancy as an all-time record high. So the 98% occupancy, and this is coming from our proprietary survey, but the new and most hottest segment of the market is build for rent. So if you haven't heard about build for rent, this is where the wall of capital is shifting. They're going after what is a needed part of the housing market, shelter, but they believe that people want flexibility and optionality, even though that home ownership is soaring. They're concerned that many can't afford to buy or don't have the down payment. So we're now seeing a lot more single family rental operators that are trying to partner with builders because they don't have that expertise. And we do have some risk that if they continue to increase development at the pace that they're going in certain select markets, there could be some concentration risk. On the other hand, it does provide countercyclical returns for builders that are going to possibly at some point see a correction and have too much inventory. They can sell to these investors for basically pretty attractive returns. Just in terms of one more on single family rental, I just wanted to show you that right now, when you compare the size of the market, in fourth quarter it was roughly 4.5% of the market. I will tell you that that's national. If you looked at where it was going to be in 2021, I would say at minimum nationally 10%. But if you went into certain markets, the hottest smile states, we have builders that are doing 25 to 30% of their total written business is being sold to build for rent operators. So it's really faster than the whole national numbers depict. Lastly, just on my forecast, right now we'll be publishing our macro forecast for all housing metrics before the holidays. So a lot of these numbers are going to change, but you can see here in the production home building order side, we have very strong 23% growth. I think the numbers are biased to the upside. Same thing for 21. We're probably biased slightly to the upside. Same thing for housing starts. Housing starts are in 2020 running a little bit less than the 15%, but that would mean that 21 is going to be that much higher. So just keep that in mind. Notice that we show in 22 declines for new orders and housing starts. That's really a function of our view that the market is going to see some normalization as we get effective vaccines and our COVID castles are no longer our priority. We're going to see some share of wallet going to other segments of the market. People want to travel, they want to do other things, and the housing market may not be the only thing on their mind. And we think we'll get some normalization. But even with the declines we're showing, it's still a fundamentally very good market. And we show the same thing for existing home closings. Our price forecast, it didn't get updated for the slide. I apologize. As I mentioned, we're 9.7 for 20. We're 6% for 21. And we're 2.8 for 22. So still price appreciation, even if we see a correction in on the volume side with respect to the market fundamentals. And then some other data points to point out, home improvement coming down, just lapping very tough comparisons. Home centers, Home Depot and Lowe's, you know, hard to lap 25, 30% same store sales comps. So that's really where you see the decline coming from. Multifamily developers are recognizing they can't pencil the returns given lease rates are under pressure. And on the dollar, the mortgage origination forecast that we show here, again, we're updating those forecasts, probably a little bit better than we show in 21 and probably looking at, or 20 and 21, same thing on refis, probably a bias to the upside. So for those of you that are in our program and are part of the network, you'll be receiving that update early next week. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Nicole, and see if there's any time for questions.
We do have a couple of questions, Ivy. Thank you so much. And what fabulous information. Somebody was asking, and it's a great question. Of course, at Fairway, we do forward mortgages and reverse. Somebody was asking, what about the home ownership buying trends for those over the age of 62? What are you seeing?
Well, actually, the trend has been more favorable than we had expected because consumer confidence, we thought with this COVID shutdown and just the risks, were going to keep that buyer more hesitant. But a lot of the builders at our network that we survey, as well as the public builders, do active adult projects. And they're seeing strong demand for those projects right now, especially in the resort areas. So if they've got the product, they're sold out and they're metering. And I'd say that market segment is probably one of the more stronger parts of the various breadth of product offering. But it was initially weaker, but it's accelerated and it's very strong right now.
And when you said 6% appreciation is what you're expecting nationwide, do you see that or do you go into what that looks like from a metro perspective or from a regional perspective, where you think the hot markets are?
We do. We don't actually give a forecast per MSA, but because of the work that we do both through the brokers and the builders, we can triangulate where we see the greatest level of strength. So we just published our home building survey. So, you know, we show you by market, which is seeing the strongest pricing power. And we do the same with the brokers. So it's really more ability to gauge where the strength is the greatest and who has the strongest appreciation, but we don't actually forecast the individual markets.
Okay. And I know, Sarah, you had mentioned that you had a question as well. I want to turn that over.
I do. Ivy, are you starting to see where they're tearing down the commercial retail, commercial office, and building multifamily or single family if they can rezone it? Are you starting to see that across the nation?
I'd say that if it is happening, it's very negligible and not enough. I know there's more discussion from the commercial landlords that could come to fruition, but right now we don't need more multifamily. What we're seeing is like more of a garden style, you know, if anything, hybrid with a little townhome communities, but those are very difficult to rezone in cities, any of the commercial to actually get to where the demand would be, where people want to be in less dense areas. So that may happen more out in the suburbs, but I don't really see it working in the denser parts of the country in urban cities, because they're already laden with that, with so much supply coming. So it just would not likely be a good return for the operators to do that.
Perfect. Nicole, anything else from you? And Ivy, this was amazing. Just amazing. Anything,
Thank
Nicole?
You. I have one last question that I've been kind of thinking about with, and I'm also thinking about Biden's $640 billion plan and the affordable housings that he wants to build, as well as having rent control. You add that to what you brought up at the very end, talking about, what did you say, 20 to 30% of these builds are actually built for rent, not for an end home purchaser. Do you think that those are going to have impact on rents long-term? Like for those of us who are small investors, will we start to see rents decline with a glut of more rental opportunities?
Well, first from, President-elect Biden is talking more about affordable housing that would be, you know, kind of in a Section 8, more of a subsidized product that he might utilize through tax incentives to developers. The current build for rent product is actually expensive. So if you want to buy a home, let's say in Central Florida in the $250,000 range, and you do a 95% LTV, your monthly payment could be under $1,000 at current rates. That same house in terms of, you know, a single family rental is being rented out at $1,200 to $1,400 a month. So the question is, why would people rent when they can own at a much more favorable rate? And the reason is they don't either have the credit, or they want to have more flexibility, or they're just there temporarily because they're building a house. So right now the occupancy at 98%. So I'm just concerned that rental stock is not really affordable compared to what would be ownership. And there's so much of it coming in certain select markets that the consumer will benefit if the rents become too elevated and they have to actually reduce rents. But what we're seeing in other parts of the country, if rents are coming down substantially, the one thing I didn't mention, household formations are under pressure, because the young adults that were living in the cities, they move back in with their families or with friends. And they're doing so to save money, because why pay in New York City $6,000 a month to rent a one bedroom apartment? They are now recognizing they can save that money, and yet now you can rent a one bedroom for $4,200. So the more rents come down, it might stimulate in certain cities more demand. But we estimate households are declining pretty substantially in unemployment. Even though Barry and Dan pointed out incomes are rising, we still have tens of millions of people, or whatever the number is, less than 7% are unemployed. So that's a pressure on the market that I think is going to keep the demand side from just snapping back.
This was incredibly helpful, Ivy. I always get so much from your insights, so I appreciate you sharing them with us today and sharing your time.
And please, if you're not involved with Zelman and are interested in the exchange, I know Nicole will share the slides with you.
Yeah, Ivy, where do we find you?
Email me at ivy@zelmanassociates.com. or my assistant, Kim, at kim@zelmanassociates.com. But thanks for asking,
yeah.
Sarah.
Yeah. Nicole, thank you. Thank you as always. And such great information on what's ahead.
You've been listening to The Double Comma Club. Never miss an episode. Subscribe at TheDoubleCommaClub.com or your favorite podcast venue to hear more success stories. Get free tips on how you can get on the path to becoming a millionaire through real estate at any age. If you enjoyed this, you might also enjoy our YouTube channel. Just look for The Roof Team on YouTube or visit our site, theroofteam.com.